Why is a potter interested in sandbags? And what is kaplomacy? Well, today you can have the answer. Good afternoon. I am Chrissy Hewitt. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program that my co-host, Stephen DeLuque, and I produce here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Today, I continue my conversation with Michael J. Strand, who is an associate professor and head of visual arts at North Dakota State University, which is in Fargo. I met up with Michael last May at a national metalsmithing conference that was held in Boston. Even though he is a ceramicist, his artistic practice is based in the belief that craft has a great potential for being a catalyst for social change. He writes, "From prayer shawls to peace pipes, objects have been directly connected to social movements throughout human history. In the 21st century, object makers build on this tradition of leading movements to humanize an increasingly inhumane world." Last week, Michael discussed his personal history, the value of a daily job as a paperboy that he started at age 9, and the influences of his very socially active mother. His study of art did not start until college, but he clearly remembers the day when he realized that this was going to be what his life was about. Today, he discusses two of his projects. One is about saving Fargo from floodwaters. The other is a project he calls Kaplomacy. Both of these and several others you can find on his website, michael.j.strand. I certainly encourage you to look him up, as I think you will find not only his philosophy, but his work quite interesting. Here now is Michael J. Strand.
The things that I do are not just about, like, how do I do things to connect communities? It's about how do we establish new markets and opportunities for artists. And you can't do that by marketing our work. We need to change the nature in which we exist in culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's this thing around the warmth of a handmade object. Like, this is specific to craft. That isn't that a warm, inviting piece of jewelry, or because it's handmade? It is to people who understand what warm and inviting is, right?
Right.
I experienced this coming to SNAG conference. I'm looking at jewelry. I don't have the visual language. I can look at it as an artist and say, that's interesting. But I don't look at it and say, well, that's warm and inviting. I look at it like I'm interested as a design thing, or I'm interested as an expression thing. But I hear that a lot. Like, well, you know, people just, they want to have handmade things around them. Like, I mean, I think there is a movement around that. But when you got handmade, handcrafted pickles in a hardware store, which I just experienced last week. I went to a hardware store in my town, and there's like handcrafted pickles. That's no longer even a relevant concept that what we do is unique. We might fight against that, but that's a reality. But what we do bring with what we make is a perspective and a philosophy. And I think that has value. And the way that it can be expressed in culture as an experience, in culture as a different way to think, even like educational concepts within culture, people are actually after that. If you look at the way that we engage in social media, it's about being connected to ideas and people. Like, that's why an app that connects people is digital technology, but it's actually an experience. So as makers, how do we understand the potential of that? The kind of hunkering in and saying, well, people just really need to understand why this is so valuable. Why don't people get this? We're just becoming a dumb culture. I'm like, no, it's like because maybe we are not doing what it takes to actually, one, find the right way to express that, and maybe two, not putting the effort into that side of making. So I literally, within my own practice, think about the things that we make and the people And then the way that we acquire or the way that we encounter something, that space. But that space, if you just simply remove the dollar signs for a moment and you just think about the way that that happens, is where a remarkable opportunity exists to be creative. It sounds abstract.
Yeah. In some ways and other ways, it's becoming more and more concrete to me all the time. In part because I get very concerned from either social media or other things that we are so desperate for a sense of connection, and we take it in what is becoming one of the most distancing possible terms. So if I were on Facebook and said I had 500 friends and 450 of them I wouldn't even recognize if I walked by them,
right?
That to me is a disconnect. We have an open studios program in our county once a year, and having people come by and realizing the thirst for why are you doing what you're doing? You really will hammer that piece of metal 50,000 times to make it into a bowl?
Right.
Well, maybe you're a fool, but maybe there's, you know, something else going on. And people wanting to try it.
You want to get them there.
You want to get involved. But I'm trying to give some of those opportunities in a way that is much more about how can we exchange ideas.
And advocate.
And advocate. That's been a difficult thing with this studio tour because so many artists are fixated on, did I make enough money this weekend?
Right.
And trying to help them say, think more about engaging with people on a different kind of level. You're going to have more fun unless you're sitting there and your cash register isn't ringing and you're getting more and more annoyed that people aren't getting it.
Right.
Then why be open?
No other field behaves that way. Like no other field would just wonder why. And it's not about marketing, right? It's not about if we do better advertising. It's about how we think about our field and how it's continuously relevant, not how culture is relevant to what our field is. I mean, this whole thing of like craft can save the world, or I think that is an empowering statement. What that really means is that I believe strongly if we adjust what we do to really look at what are some of the potentials within culture, that we can have an impact. But what is not going to happen, I believe strongly, is that if we just wait for culture to come to us and smarten up, kids just don't care anymore. Well, how are you making sure that we don't teach art anymore? Why? How are we making the case? And it's always we're trying to do that. But it's more like how do we engage with those people who oppose us with artistic ideas so that they see the potential of it, not just the narrative of it, right? Not just the kind of rhetoric.
And that seems to be the perfect segue into the gut-wrenching and very heartwarming examples of what it is that you are doing.
Yeah. I look at the world as systems and not places. Now, there's a big placemaking movement, and I really, really respect and appreciate that, but I look at that as somewhat limiting, only in that because oftentimes it's a geographic location. But as systems, we have things that move through our communities, nation, global systems that are moving information and people and ideas. How can we look at those systems as an opportunity to kind of move an idea into it? This is a very specific example. So my mother, like I was talking, was a community activist and really involved the YMCA. And the YMCA has a park named in her honor, which was really amazing. And when she passed away, they said, well, would you do a public, would you do a piece for her, a memorial? Yeah, I was like, I don't really do my sculpture of my mom or something.
Right.
But I'll think about how I can do something that would honor her in a way that fits the way that I think. So we deal with a flood fight. Now, it's been like 3 years because we've had a dry spell. There's no flooding happening right now, but there was consistently, even when I grew up in Fargo, Moorhead, a flood almost every year. But they were particularly devastating in 2009 to 2011, 12. And there was a continuous kind of pressure for the citizens to save the city by sandbagging. And when we were talking sandbagging in 2009, it was 3 million sandbags and an urgent call for people to... The federal government said to evacuate the city, and the mayor basically said, no way, we're going to save the city. Because they were just going to let the city go, the federal government. It was a big story back in 2009. It was like people were watching this, like, how is Fargo going to be gone? Now, Grand Forks, which is north of us, did suffer that. the entire city was wiped out, like the downtown area, and had to rebuild. So we're dealing with this a lot. Well, within that system, what you have are sandbags, right, obviously. And sandbags are white. I just saw it as a really prime opportunity to kind of move ideas through a system, but also will hopefully affect some sort of change to a very draconian situation. So how can art be part of emergency management was the question I had. And so what I did is I went to the city and asked for 1,000 sandbags. And there was some resistance, of course, right? But one person, Dan Molly, really cared about the project. And he got that. What I was saying is that we're not creating an art exhibition with sandbags. We're not. That's not what we're going to do is allow people who couldn't help with the flood fighting effort to communicate words of encouragement to people who were doing the hard work.
So I don't have the strength to fill a sandbag
right.
or to toss it to the next person or
right.
whatever, but I can.
But you can participate in a project that helps in whatever way you can. I got 1,000 sandbags to start with and distributed those through assisted living facilities and nursing homes and hospital spaces where people didn't have the physical ability, literally,
right.
to be part of the system. And also connected with the entire school system and distributed bags throughout the school system, basically age, you know, 7th grade and lower. It was very simple. I provided markers, sandbags, and said, you know, draw and write a message of encouragement to people who are assisting with saving the city. And of course, when you put a sandbag into a 2nd grade class, like remarkable things happen. One, they're talking about the flood, and they're talking about, like, I'm helping, and they... Like, there's so many rainbows and sunshine and rain and, like, people with muscles and really heartwarming imagery. And then from nursing, assisting living, I love that there was a sense of humor at times that was also edgy, like, don't get your feet wet or, you know, thank you, we really appreciate it. And so these were then integrated into the flood fighting system, about one every 40 bags. But what would happen is they had these stacks of sandbags, and the sandbags would move through the system, and... And the city, after they totally got it, would move one of the painted or drawn-on sandbags into the system. And like as you were bagging, one would come by, like a pink robot. And at that moment, it did. It like lifted people's spirits. They're like, wow, that's, you know, that's fun. And they were always looking for the next one. When you're doing that, it changes the nature of that environment, right? And that's a perfect example of how art, it's like a little hack, right? I think of it as literally... like a hack for good. I mean, maybe I'm using that term liberally, but what I mean is that there's something that's happening and you just alter it a little bit. And that little alteration changes, maybe not massively, but begins to shift the nature of that of what is a very serious situation. And it worked. So what happened was over the course of 2 weeks, 9,000 sandbags were by 6,000 people participated. From 13 states. It was sort of like a little viral thing happened with the project. On some level, it's so, so easy. So when I talk about looking at the world as systems and looking at the way in which we move our ideas into the world in new ways, that's what I mean. In the end, it went through the hands of the people bagging, went through the people who stacked the pallets went out to the field, then people would take from the pallets and put them in the wall. You have to imagine, like, the wall that was protecting the city, every 10 feet or so, one of these images would be there. To satisfy people who want to understand how it can exist as art, as an image, there it is. Like, there's your exhibition in a completely new way. And we didn't hang paintings on sandbag walls. They were inherently part of the protection. And so the value extends from people who are there, people who are stacking, and then the homeowners who then look out and see that the community is caring. Changes the nature of a system. Now, back to what your question about my mother, I integrated 63 pink sandbags into the system. She died of pancreatic cancer at that age. Into the system, I found a couple of them, but these were dispersed. And it was a memorial for her. It was the only ones I did, and I just spray painted them, and they're pink. I think it was very fitting. And I didn't talk about it that way at the time at all. That was not the point. I was happy that, in some ways, the project just became the Fargo Sandbag Project, and it wasn't mine. I mean, sheriffs were, like, starting to say, hey, can I do this? Sure. Just, like, run it around your county and let people draw on them, and you don't need to ask permission. So that's a good example of looking at the world as a system. And this is the question. People, like, who are thinking commodity, well, did you make any money doing that? Like, how did you sell? Did you write a grant? I didn't write a grant because it was too urgent. It was right. Volunteer. But tell me where you can buy the cultural capital for a city, civic structure, to understand the value of art moving into a community and helping in a real, tangible way. Because it did. It also, hearing back from the city, they started playing music, and it was just different tenor around this. The value is cultural capital. And as a researcher at a university, that's my primary concern with that project. You can't buy that. I can't write a grant. It can only happen when you extend ideas into a situation like that.
And you're not sure or even wanting to control where those ideas go.
Right.
For the next year, for 2 months
right.
later, for whatever might be happening. It,
right.
it might start festivals. It might start something else because
right.
people want that community sense still.
Right.
And they don't want to wait for the next flood to feel like they're part of a system.
Yeah, but on some level, a sheriff saying, can I do the project, tells me that's a sustainable thing and it's important.
And has it repeated itself?
The last time I did it, which was 2012. Yeah, is the last year that it was needed. A whole collection of people in our community are doing things like this. And it is a movement across the country to deal with that kind of social space.
This is KCBX Public Radio, and you're listening to Ears on Art, a program produced here at the station. This is Chrissy Hewitt, and I am talking with Michael J. Strand, who is an associate professor and head of visual arts at North Dakota State University. We continue now as Michael discusses his philosophy and describes another one of his projects, this one using his artistic discipline of clay.
And so places teaching this, I understand why they want to teach it. I teach it to students. But really, I think it's as simple as saying, what do you do, what do you value, and where is the intersecting points in that? And objects, that's the other part about the whole social practice world, is that there was this kind of denial of the objectness, as if that historically was not part of social movement. It's ridiculous. The problem is, then it exists in the headspace without an anchor sometimes, where the only people that really care are the people who are doing the work. I was given talks at the National Social Engagement Conference twice. Mm. At one of the conferences, I was waiting in line for lunch, and this guy asked what I do. I said, I'm a potter. And he said, well, what does that have to do with social practice? He couldn't figure it out. And I said, well, you know, that 25,000 years of participatory history give me a pretty unique advantage doing this kind of work. And I love, like, the look on his face. He's like, oh, wow, yeah. Like, I said, yeah, I don't need to have to reinvent the interface, right? At my talk, I asked, who used a cup today? Like, it's such a ridiculous question. I said, no, really, who used a cup today? Everybody. And I'm like, wow, well, that gives me a unique opportunity to move an idea into your hands.
And it was only 9 in the morning.
It was only 9 in the morning, yes. So that object is part of our daily life. Well, and the sandbag is an object as well. And I see it as a craft project, because I like to think of and advocate
right.
for craft.
You had two other great examples, and I'm sure that they're more than that.
Yeah.
There was the bowl project, but there was also the cup
yeah.
project.
Yeah. The Senate project.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about the Senate project because it's in process. And being in process still means that it's art existing. So I'm working on this project for 5 years because it's a very difficult project. 5 years ago, I thought, well, I mean, I'm a potter. How are ways that the inherent use of what we make can be utilized? I use the same things I tell my students, like, what do you care about and what do you make? And I'm very political. I was just so frustrated. This was right around the time of the collapse of our economy that there was no dialogue. And there used to be, because I dug into this. And like, what I found out is that on the surface, it would look like they were arguing, but at night they would go and have beers together. Well, that had changed. It was no longer on surface, there was disconnect. And then after hours, there was no interchange. Like, it really was no longer about dialogue at all. It wasn't even the theater of disagreement.
Right.
And I think some of them still do that, but not in general. That's changed, especially with a lot of the infusion of very polarizing opinions. Well, a cup of coffee has been a way that a lot of people solve disagreements. Have you ever had an exchange that escalates into something that you should never have gone there? And you're like, I think we're just missing the boat here with both of us. And you sit down, you have a cup of coffee, sit down at a table, and you just have a conversation. And you're like, wow, why didn't we just do this instead of typing? So the idea is that a set of cups and saucers is made for each party, one for Republicans, one for the Democrats. And then each senator gets a cup and saucer, but they get the opposing party, quote-unquote, saucer and their party's cup. with the prompt to go across the aisle. And when they go across the aisle, go out for a cup of coffee and swap saucers, right? And when that happens, bling, they have a matching set. So started it 5 years ago, and I like to use this. This is a really important thing about this kind of work. It's taken 5 years because if you're going to assume a project like this, you have to do it right. And so there's several times that I almost had it ready, and then I for one way, reason or another, did not work out. Twice it was because I went through U.S. Senate offices to have them run the project through their office to distribute, and at the last moment or mid-moment, they pulled out. So I would go down this path of communication with the Senate office, even going to Washington, D.C. in one case, and sitting down with staffers, and they were like, yeah, interested, and they'll get back to me, and then somebody would stop it, right? That's okay. I learned each time, right. So it's taken time. And the other part is the realization, and I love this concept, and it's what's now fueled the project to now completion in September, is that I was in love with an idea and it was a bad relationship. I was so enamored with my cute hook, right?
Right.
Like the brilliance of how simple that is. I was so damn happy that I forgot that what I do most effectively is engage people. So the hook of it being this potter from North Dakota delivering cups, it could have worked, but I think it would have been more of like a stunt. And that's not a bad thing in this case, because it's like Mr. Smith goes to Washington, the potter from North Dakota who thought, you know, Sanders needed a cup of coffee. Over time, I realized that that's not what I wanted. One, it's an incredible amount of pressure that I really feared.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time I ever feared. Usually, I'm like, I'm just going, right? So what I did is I engaged with 1,000 people from North Dakota and asked some very simple questions, like what's the state of our political affairs? How do you want our politicians to interact? Name a Republican that you admire or appreciate and a Democrat. Now, I'm asking for both, you know, and I ask in one word. The first one is simple. What's the state of our political affairs? Easily, well over 95% of the respondents said in some way, like, chaotic. That wasn't unexpected, but coming from a red state, North Dakota is, that response was important. The second question is what was surprising. It's where I took the risk. How do you want our politicians to work together? Almost the same, maybe slightly less of the respondents talked about in some way harmoniously.
And these were one-word answers.
This is not pure social research, like from a social scientist point of view. I'm an artist, and so what I'm collecting is narratives. And people knew why I was collecting the information. So that, obviously it leads it in a direction. However, what I have collected through that is a whole different narrative to present to U.S. senators. So these are the responses, and we have a website at diplomacy.com. Then we use the information about what's the quality of each party to work in a design shred, a small group of people who took those words and kind of broke them down into a core set of qualities for each party that was pretty consistent. And the trends were this. It was very simple, and each one honors both parties. I would say that I was a pretty close 50-50 response rate. The Democrats, more human, kind of twist in the wind a little bit, like let's respond, and they kind of move, right? Not flip-flop move, right? Willing to move maybe too quickly. And so these forms, and even they kind of rotate, and they twist, and they're fluted. The Republicans is very upright as a form, and it's hard to do on radio, but essentially if you can imagine my hands going up at an angle and then straight up. We have an idea, and we're sticking to it. This is what we're doing. And a bit more closed. Not closed-minded, but just more like, this is what we're doing, and protective of the coffee inside. The coffee cup for the Democrats is kind of open. The coffee is kind of exposed, and it's kind of there, right? And so we've designed these cups around that. And then on each cup and saucer, there's the image of the most popular answer, which in the case of the Republicans was Ronald Reagan, and in the case of the Democrats was John F. Kennedy. And there is a little like sweetness for me around this. When they're not matching, that it's Ronald Reagan and JFK kind of face-to-face, you know, when the cup and saucer are together.
The image is on the bottom of the cup and up in the center of the saucer.
Yeah, so if you imagine you're looking at the bottom of the cup and you look at the saucer and there's Ronald Reagan and JFK kind of kissing, you know, or whatever you want to think of. I think that's kind of a funny way to think of it. There's a sense of humor around that, and it's not dishonoring that, but it's also creating a little bit more tension around wanting to get them to be exchanged and...
Or the possibility that they want to keep their two-sidedness and say, hey, if we're going to have coffee, we get to acknowledge that.
And there's that part,
there's
too.
There's that part of us here. So
they're going to be delivered by mail or in person by a member of each state. and to their state senators. The symbolic value of the project isn't just that opportunity to do that, it's that it symbolizes access, right? If a potter working with Helen Otterson, who's another ceramic artist who's really been my collaborator along with Peter Atwood, who's a digital designer, we are like, it's a three-person project. Them coming in the last year has really made the project happen. So that these artists from North Dakota, along with, it'll be well over 1,000 people lending their voice to this, is a different way to talk about access and how we talk about the way in which we want our elected officials to work together. I have the opposing viewpoint all the time in my projects. Like, if you knew that if our senators talked together and negotiated, that you wouldn't get everything you want, would you still want them to communicate? Or do you really want to be a win-loss situation at all times? And that also begins to extend the conversation into our hearts. Is it really only about that issue that you are only going to support that about that issue?
Right.
Or is there a way to acknowledge that collectively we may have different opinions and that collectively we need to govern and that maybe the way that that happens has to be somewhere in between? So that project, diplomacy.com, and you can see an opportunity for anybody to fill out this form digitally, to lend their voice to the project. A cup delivered to a senator could have 50 people who signed on to the cup from this person, this person, this person. You just need your name and address. So a cup might come from 500 people. I'm facilitating the cup. It's not coming from me. I'm a choreographer, in a way, as an artist. As a human being, we need to be filled as well as give. So this is not about me just also being separating myself from the project. I want my acknowledgement as a choreographer because it's a hell of a lot of work.
Absolutely. Also, the fact that you understand that a choreographer is not the one dancing every role.
No, that's exactly right. No, that's perfect, right? Exactly. So Helen having a lead role in the project and Peter Atwood having a leading role. And
if we continue with that analogy, then the chorus is all the rest of us who sign on.
Right. And so everybody's part of this this. I think of it as a movement, right? But I think that point about ego and public work in service and volunteerism, even as a maker, that we should in some way only do things through the perspective of anonymous. The problem with that is that we can't then inspire other people to do things. The Senate project's really exciting.
And people can find out about some of the other projects past and in the future. Generic website for those?
Yeah, so it's just michaeljstrand.com. Objects, humanity, and the space in between, I think in ways that are experimental, and I like to think of them as fun and a bit edgy at the same time.
Well, Michael, this has been terrific. I'm so glad that paths crossed and that you were willing to sit and have this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Happy to have the conversation.
Terrific. My guest today has been Michael J. Strand, who is an associate professor and head of visual arts at North Dakota State University. I encourage you to visit his website, michael.j.strand, and discover more about these intriguing projects. You are listening to KCBX Public Radio, and the program has been Ears on Art, which my co-host, Stephen DeLuque, and I produce here. If you miss part one, please go to the KCBX website and search for Ears on Art, and you can listen to it there. This is Chrissy Hewitt, and on behalf of Stephen DeLuque, I want to thank you so much for listening.